Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Dave Bazanko. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust back in 2002 and goes out every Tuesday lunchtime at 12 o'clock. This week, we have an interview with John Perkins, author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Also, the second half of an interview recorded of Diana, Princess of Wales by Martin Bashir for the Panoramic Programme. Dialect is produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk, and I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. First aired back in November of 2013, this interview with John Perkins discusses how Greece has fallen victim to economic hitmen.
Joining us today on the Dialogos Radio and the Dialogos interview series is John Perkins, the author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman. John, welcome to our program today.
Thanks. It's great to be with you today.
In your book, you write about how you were for many years a so-called economic hitman. Who are these economic hitmen and what do they do?
Well, essentially, my job was to identify countries that had resources that our corporations want. And that could be things like oil, or it could be markets. It could be transportation systems, locations. There's so many different things. Once we identify these countries, to arrange huge loans to these countries, but the money would never actually go to the countries. Instead, it would go to our own corporations to build infrastructure projects in those countries, things like power plants and highways that benefited a few wealthy people as well as our own corporations, but not the majority of the people who couldn't afford to buy into these things. And yet they were left holding a huge debt, very much like what Greece has today, this phenomenal debt. And once bound by that debt, we would go back, usually in the form of the IMF, and in the case of Greece today, it's the IMF and the EU, and make tremendous demands on the country, increase taxes, cut back on spending, sell public sector things to private companies, things like power companies and water systems, transportation systems, privatize those. In other words, basically become a slave to us, to the corporations, to the IMF, to, in your case, the EU. And basically, the organizations like the World Bank, the IMF, the EU are tools of big corporations, what I call the corporatocracy.
And before turning specifically to the case of Greece, let's talk a little bit more about the manner in which these economic hitmen and these organizations like the IMF operate. You mentioned, of course, how they go in and they work to get these countries into massive debt, that money goes in and then goes straight back out. You also mentioned in the book these overly optimistic growth forecasts that are sold to the politicians of these countries, but which really have no semblance with reality.
Exactly. You know, yeah, we'd like to show that if these investments were made in things like electric energy systems, that the economy would grow at phenomenally high rates. The fact of the matter is, when you do invest in these big infrastructure projects, you do see economic growth. However, most of that growth reflects the wealthy getting wealthier and wealthier. It doesn't reflect the majority of the people. And we're seeing that in the United States today, for example, where, you know, we can show economic growth at times, growth in GDP, but at the same time, unemployment may be going up or staying level, and foreclosures on houses may be going up or staying level. So these numbers tend to reflect the very wealthy because they have a huge percentage of the economy, statistically speaking. But nonetheless, we would show that when you invest in these infrastructure projects, your economy does grow, and yet we would even show it growing much faster than it ever conceivably would. And that was all used to serve to justify these horrendous loans, these incredibly debilitating loans.
Is there a common theme with regards to the countries that are typically targeted? Are they, for instance, rich in resources, or do they typically possess some other sort of strategic importance to the powers that be?
Yes, all of those. You know, like it was really dependent. So resources can take many different forms. So one is the material resources like minerals, oil, and other minerals. Another resource is strategic location. Another resource could be big marketplaces or cheap labor. So different countries meet different requirements. And I think actually what we're seeing in Europe today is even different from all of, and that includes Greece.
What happens once these countries that have been targeted are indebted? How do these major powers, these economic hitmen, these international organizations come back and get their pound of flesh, if you will, from the countries that are heavily in debt?
By insisting that the countries adopt policies that will sell their publicly owned sectors, such as utility companies, water and sewage systems, maybe schools and transportation systems, even jails, to big corporations, privatize, allow us to build military bases on their soil. Many different things that can be done, but basically they become servants to what I call the corporatocracy. We have to remember that today we have a global empire, and it's not an American empire. It's not a national empire. It doesn't help the American people very much. It's a corporate empire. The big corporations rule. They control the politics of the United States. To a large degree, they control a great deal of the policies in countries like China and around the world.
We are speaking with John Perkins, the author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, here on Diálogos Radio and the Diálogos Interview Series. John, looking specifically now at the case of Greece, of course you mentioned your belief that the country has become the victim of economic hitman and of these international organizations. What was your reaction when you first heard about the crisis in Greece and about the measures that were to be implemented in the country?
Well, I've been following Greece for a long time. I was on Greek television for several years, and a Greek film company did a documentary called Apology of an Economic Hitman. And I also spent a lot of time in Iceland and in Ireland, and I was invited to Iceland to help encourage the people there to vote on a referendum not to repay their debts. And I did that and encouraged them not to, and they did vote no. And as a result, Iceland's doing quite well now economically compared to the rest of Europe, and Iceland's considered to be in the European zone. Ireland, on the other hand, did the same thing there, but Ireland, the Irish people apparently voted against the referendum, although there have been many reports that it was probably, that in fact the Irish people may have voted for the referendum, but there was a lot of corruption. And in the case of Greece, watching this, my reaction is Greece is being hit. You know, there's no question about it. The people, sure, Greece made a mistake. Your leaders made some mistakes, but the people didn't really make the mistakes. And now the people are being asked to pay for the mistakes that were made by their leaders, often in cahoots with the big banks. So people made tremendous amounts of money off these so-called mistakes. And now the people who didn't make the mistakes are being asked to pay the price. And that's consistent around the world. We see it in so many places. We've seen it in Latin America. We've seen it in Asia. We've seen it in so many places around the world.
And this leads directly to the next question I had, which is, from my observation, at least in Greece, the crisis has been accompanied by an increase in what I would describe as self-blame or self-loathing. There's this sentiment in Greece that many people have that the country failed, that the people failed. There's hardly even protests in Greece anymore. And of course, there's also a huge brain drain. There's a lot of people that are leaving the country. Does this all seem very familiar to you when comparing to other countries in which you've had a personal experience?
Sure, that's part of the game, you know, convince people that they're wrong, they're inferior. You know, the corporatocracy is incredibly good at that. Whether back during the Vietnam War, convincing the world that the North Vietnamese were evil and lousy and poor, today it's the Muslims, or, you know, it's a policy of the them versus us. And we are good, we are right, we do everything right, you're wrong. And in this case, all this energy has been directed at the Greek people to say, you're lazy, you didn't do the right things, you didn't follow the right policies, blah, 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 blah. Where in actuality, an awful lot of the blame needs to be laid on the financial community that encouraged Greece to go down this route. And I would say that we have something very similar going on in the United States, where people are being led to believe that because their houses are being foreclosed, they were stupid, they bought the wrong houses, they overspent themselves. The fact of the matter is their bankers told them to do this. And around the world, we've come to trust bankers, or we used to. We used to trust bankers. In the United States, we never believed that a banker would tell us that we could buy a $500,000 house if, in fact, we could really only afford a $300,000 house. We thought it was in the bank's interest not to foreclose. But that changed a few years ago, and bankers told people who they knew could only afford a $300,000 house to buy a $500,000 house. Tighten your belt. In a few years, that house will be worth $1 million. You'll make a lot of money. In fact, the value of the house went down. The market dropped out. The banks then repackaged these houses, foreclosed on them, repackaged them, and sold them again. Double whammy. the people were told, you were stupid. Why did you ever buy such an expensive house? You were greedy. You were stupid. But in actuality, the bankers told them to do this. And we'd grown up to believe that we could trust our bankers. Something very similar on a larger scale happened in so many countries around the world, including Greece.
In Greece, the traditional major political parties are, of course, overwhelmingly in favor of the harsh austerity measures that have been imposed. But also we see that the major business interests and also the major media moguls, the major media interests in the country, are also overwhelmingly in support. Does this surprise you in the slightest?
No. Well, it doesn't surprise me, and yet it's ridiculous, because austerity doesn't work. We've proven that time and time again. And perhaps the greatest proof was the opposite in the United States during the Great Depression, when President Roosevelt initiated all these policies to put people back to work, to pump money into the economy. That's what works. We know that austerity does not work in these situations. We also have to understand that, you know, in the United States, for example, over the past 40 years, the middle class has actually been in decline in a real dollar basis, while the economy has been increasing. And in fact, that's pretty much happened around the world. Globally, the middle class has been in decline. Big business needs to recognize, it hasn't yet, but it needs to recognize that serves nobody's long-term interest, that the middle class is the market. And if the middle class continues to be in decline, whether it's in Greece or the United States or globally, ultimately businesses will pay the price. They won't have customers. You know, Henry Ford once said, I want to pay all my workers enough money so they can go out and buy Ford cars. That's a very good policy. That's wise. This austerity program moves in the opposite direction, and it's a foolish policy.
In your book, which was written, I believe, in 2004, you expressed hope that the euro would serve as a counterweight to American global hegemony, to the hegemony of the U.S. dollar. Did you ever expect that we would see in the European Union what we are seeing today, with austerity that is not just in Greece, but also in Spain, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, and several other countries as well?
Well, by the time I wrote my latest book, Hoodwink, I certainly did. It was, and really, Confessions of an Economic Hitman wasn't dealing quite so much in that subject. But what I didn't realize during any of this period was how much corporatocracy does not want a united Europe. We need to understand this. They may be happy enough with a euro, with one currency. They're happy to a certain degree by having it united enough that markets are open. But they do not want standardized rules and regulations. Because let's face it, the big corporations, the corporatocracy, takes advantage of the fact that some countries in Europe have much more lenient tax laws. Some have much more lenient environmental and social laws, and they can pit them against each other. You know, what would it be like for big corporations if they didn't have their tax havens in places like Monaco and other places? I think we need to recognize, I think that what the corporatocracy saw at first, a solid euro, a European Union, seemed like a very good thing. But as it moved forward, they could see that what was going to happen was that social and environmental laws and regulations were going to be standardized across the board. They didn't want that. So to a certain degree, what's been going on in Europe has been because the corporatocracy wants Europe to fail, at least at a certain level.
You wrote about the example of Ecuador, which after the collapse of oil prices in the late 80s, it found itself unable to pay back the very huge debts that it had accumulated. And this, of course, led to massive austerity measures, which sounds all very similar to what we are now seeing in Greece. How did the people of Ecuador and also other countries that found themselves in similar situations, how did they eventually resist?
Well, Ecuador elected a pretty remarkable president, Rafael Correa, who has a PhD in economics from a United States university. He understands the system, and he understood that Ecuador took on these debts back when I was an economic hitman, and the country was ruled by a military junta that was under the control of the CIA in the U.S., and that junta took on these huge debts, put Ecuador in deep debt. The people didn't agree to that. When Correa was democratically elected, he immediately said, well, we're not paying these debts. The people did not take on these debts. Maybe the IMF should pay the debts, and maybe the junta, who were, of course, long gone, moved to Miami or someplace, should pay the debts. Maybe John Perkins and the other economic hitmen should pay the debts, but the people shouldn't. He refused to pay the debts. And since then, he's been renegotiating and bringing the debts way down and saying, well, we might be willing to pay some of them. That was a very smart move. It reflected also similar things that that have been done at different times in places like Brazil and Argentina, and more recently then following that model, Iceland, with great success. And I have to say that, you know, Correa's had some real setbacks since then. He, like so many presidents, have to be aware that if you stand up too strongly against the system, if the economic hitmen are not happy, if they don't get their way, then the jackals can come in and assassinate you or overthrow you in a coup. There was an attempted coup against him. There was a successful coup in a country not too far away from him, Honduras, because these presidents stood up. So we have to recognize that these presidents are also in very, very vulnerable positions. And ultimately, we the people have to stand up. It's because the leaders can only do a certain amount. And today, in many places, leaders are not just vulnerable. It doesn't take a bullet to bring down a leader anymore. A scandal, a sex scandal, a drug scandal can bring down a leader. We saw that happen to Bill Clinton in the United States. We saw it happen to Stars Khan of the IMF. We've seen it happen a number of times. So these leaders are very aware that they're in very, very vulnerable positions. If they stand up and they go against the status quo too strongly, they're going to be taken out one way or another. They're aware of that, and that means that it behooves we the people to really stand up for our own rights.
You mentioned the recent example of Iceland. Other than the referendum that was held, which you mentioned earlier in the interview, what other measures did the country adopt to get out of this spiral of austerity and to return to growth and to a much more positive outlook for the country?
Well, it's been investing money in programs that put people back to work, and it's also been putting on trial some of the bankers that caused the problems, which has been a big uplift in terms of morale for the people. So Iceland's launched some programs that say, well, no, we're not going to go into austerity, and we're not going to pay back these loans. We're going to put the money into putting people back to work. And ultimately, that's what drives an economy, is people working. If you've got high unemployment, like you do in Greece today, extremely high unemployment, the country's always going to be in trouble. You've got to bring down that unemployment. You've got to hire people. It's so important to put people back to work. You know, I think your unemployment rate today is something 28%, something between 25 and 30%. It's staggering. And disposable incomes, I believe, has dropped something around 40%. And it's going to continue to drop if you have high unemployment. So the important thing for an economy is to get the employment up and get disposable income back up so that people will invest in their country and in things that goods and services.
In closing, what message would you like to share with the people of Greece as they continue to experience and to live through the very harsh results of the austerity policies that have been implemented in a country for the past 3 years?
Well, I want to draw on Greece's history. You know, you're a proud, strong country, a country of warriors. The mythology of the warrior to some degree comes out of Greece, and so does democracy. And to realize that, you know, the marketplace is a democracy today, and how we spend our money is casting a ballot. Most political democracies are corrupt, including that in the United States. The democracy is not really working on a governmental basis because the corporations are in charge, but it is working on a market basis. I would really encourage the people of Greece to stand up. Don't pay off those debts. Have your own referendums. Refuse to pay off. Go to the streets and strike, as I know that recently there have been some strikes, that the Greek people are standing up to this, that some of the country's largest labor unions have been striking and stopping transportation systems. At least I know that's been planned. And so I would encourage the Greek people to continue to do this. Don't accept this criticism that it's your fault, you're to blame, you've got to suffer. Austerity, austerity, austerity. That only works for the rich people. It does not work for the normal, for the average person of the middle class. Build up that middle class, bring employment back, bring income back, disposable income back to the average citizen of Greece. Fight for that, make it happen. Stand up for your rights, respect your history as fighters and leaders in democracy, and show the world.
Well, John, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today here on the Galagos Radio, and thank you for sharing all of your insights and your experiences with us and our listeners.
My pleasure. It's been really a joy to be with you. Thank you.
That was an interview with John Perkins, author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Now for the second half of an interview recorded of Diana, Princess of Wales by Martin Bashir for the Panorama programme. Now, the first half we played for you in a previous Dialect show a couple of weeks ago.
The Queen described 1992 as her annus horribilis, and it was in that year that Andrew Morton's book about you was published. Mm-hmm. Did you ever meet Andrew Morton or personally help him with the book?
I never met him, no.
Did you ever personally assist him with the writing of his book?
A lot of people saw the distress that my life was in, and they felt it was a supportive thing to help in the way that they did.
Did you allow your friends, your close friends, to speak to Andrew Morton?
Yes, I did.
Yes, why?
I did. I was at the end of my tether. I was desperate. I think I was so fed up with being seen as someone who was a basket case, because I am a very strong person, and I know that causes complications in the system that I live in.
How would a book change that?
I don't know. Maybe people have a better understanding. Maybe there's a lot of women out there who suffer on the same level but in a different environment, who are unable to stand up for themselves because their self-esteem is cut into two. I don't know.
What effect do you think the book had on your husband and the royal family?
I think they were shocked and horrified and very disappointed.
Can you understand why?
And I think Mr. Dimbleby's book was a shock to a lot of people and disappointment as well.
What effect did Andrew Morton's book have on your relationship with the Prince of Wales?
Well, what had been hidden, or rather what we thought had been hidden, then became out in the open and was spoken about on a daily basis. And the pressure was for us to sort ourselves out in some way. Were we going to stay together or were we going to separate? And the word separation and divorce kept coming up in the media on a daily basis.
What happened after the book was published?
Well, we struggled along. We did our engagements together. And in our private life, it was obviously turbulent.
Did things come to a head?
Yes, slowly, yes. My husband and I, we discussed it very calmly. We could see what the public were requiring. They wanted clarity of a situation that was obviously becoming intolerable.
So what happened?
So we got the lawyers together, we discussed separation. Obviously there were a lot of people to discuss it with, Prime Minister, Her Majesty. And then it moved itself, so to speak.
By the December of that year, as you say, you'd agreed to a legal separation.
Mm-hmm.
What were your feelings at the time?
Deep, deep, profound sadness. So we had struggled to keep it going, but obviously we'd both run out of steam. And in a way, I suppose it could have been a relief for us both that we'd finally made our minds up. But my husband asked for separation and I supported it.
It was not your idea?
No, not at all. I come from a divorced background and I didn't want to go into that one again.
What happened next?
I asked my husband if we could put the announcement out before the children came back for school, Christmas holidays, because they were protected in the school they were at. And he did that. And it came out on December the 9th. I was on an engagement up north. I heard it on the radio. And it was just very, very sad. Really sad. A fairy tale had come to an end. And most importantly, our marriage had taken a turn, a different turn.
Did you tell your children that you were going to separate?
Yes. I went down a week beforehand and explained to them what was happening. And they took it, as children do, lots of questions. And I hoped I was able to reassure them. But who knows?
What effect do you think the announcement had on them?
I think the announcement had a huge effect on me and Charles, really. And the children were very much out of it in the sense that they were tucked away at school.
Once the separation had occurred, we move into 1993. What happened during that period?
People's agendas changed overnight. I was now a separated wife of the Prince of Wales. I was a problem. I was a liability, seen as. And how are we going to deal with her? This hasn't happened before.
Who was asking those questions?
People around me, people in this environment, and...
The royal household?
People in my environment, yes, yeah.
And they began to see you as a problem?
Yes, very much so. Mm-hmm.
How did that show itself?
By visits abroad being blocked, by things that had come naturally in my way being stopped, letters going, got lost, and various things.
So despite the fact that your interest was always to continue with your duties, you found that your duties were being held from you?
Yes. Everything changed after we separated, and life became very difficult then for me.
Who was behind that change?
Well, my husband's side were very busy stopping me.
What was your reaction when news broke of allegedly a telephone conversation between you and Mr. James Gilby having been recorded?
I felt very protective about James because he'd been a very good friend to me and was a very good friend to me. And I couldn't bear that his life was going to be messed up because he had the connection with me. And that worried me. I'm very protective about my friends.
Did you have the alleged telephone conversation?
Yes, we did. Absolutely we did. Yeah, we did.
On that tape, Mr. Gilby expresses his affection for you. Was that transcript accurate?
Yes. I mean, he is a very affectionate person. But the implications of that conversation were that we'd had an adulterous relationship, which was not true.
Have you any idea how that conversation came to be published in the national press?
No, but it was done to harm me in a serious manner, and that was the first time I'd experienced what it was like to be outside the net, so to speak, and not be in the family.
What do you think the purpose was behind it?
It was to make the public change their attitude towards me. It was, you know, if we are going to divorce, my husband would hold more cards than I would. It was a very much a poker game, chess game.
There were also a series of telephone calls which allegedly were made by you to a Mr. Oliver Hoare. Did you make what were described as nuisance phone calls?
I was reputed to have made 300 telephone calls in a very short space of time, which, bearing my lifestyle at that time, made me a very busy lady. No, I didn't. I didn't. But that, again, was a huge move to discredit me and very nearly did me in, the injustice of it. Because I did my own homework on that subject and consequently found out that a young boy had done most of them. But I read that I had done them all. Mr. Hoare told me that his lines were being tapped by the local police station. He said, you know, don't ring. So I didn't, but somebody clearly did.
Had you made any of those calls at all?
I used to, yes, I had rung up, yes.
Once, twice, three times?
I don't know, but it was a period of 6 to 9 months. A few times. But certainly not an obsessive manner, no.
Do you really believe that a campaign was being waged against you?
Yes, I did, absolutely. Yeah.
Why?
I was a separated wife to the Prince of Wales. I was a problem, full stop. Never happened before. What do we do with her?
Can't we pack her off to somewhere quietly rather than campaign against her?
She won't go quietly. That's the problem. I'll fight till the end because I believe that I have a role to fulfil. And I got 2 children to bring up.
By the end of 1993, you had suffered persistent difficulties with the press. These phone conversations were made public. And you decided to withdraw from public life.
Yeah.
Why did you do that?
The pressure was intolerable then, and my work was being affected. I wanted to give 110% to my work, and I could only give 50. I was constantly tired, exhausted, because the pressure was just, it was so cruel. So I thought the only way to do it was to stand up and make a speech and extract myself before I started disappointing and not carrying out my work. It was my decision to make that speech because I owed it to the public to say that, you know, thank you. I'm disappearing for a bit, but I'll come back.
It wasn't very long before you did come back, of course.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I did a lot of work, what I call underground, without any media attention, so I never really stopped doing it. I just didn't do every day out and about. I just couldn't do it. You know, the campaign was, in that point, was being successful. But it did surprise the people who were causing the grief. It did surprise them when I took myself out of the game. They hadn't expected that. And I'm a great believer that you should always confuse the enemy.
Who was the enemy?
Well, the enemy was my husband's department. Because I always got more publicity. My work was discussed much more than him. And, you know, from that point of view, I understand it. But I was doing good things, and I wanted to do good things. I was never going to hurt anyone. I was never going to let anyone down.
But you really believe that it was out of jealousy that they wanted to undermine you?
I think it was out of fear, because here was a strong woman doing her bit. And where was she getting her strength from to continue?
What was your reaction to your husband's disclosure to Jonathan Dimbleby? That he had, in fact, committed adultery?
Well, I was totally unaware of the content of the book and actually saw it on the news that night that it would come out. And my first concern was to the children because they were able to understand what was coming out and I wanted to protect them. But I was pretty devastated myself. But then I admired the honesty because it takes a lot to do that.
In what sense?
Well, to be honest about a relationship with someone else in his position is quite something.
How did you handle this with the children?
I went to the school and put it to William, particularly, that if you find someone you love in life, you must hang on to it and look after it. And you were very lucky to find if you were lucky enough to find someone who loved you, then one must protect it. William asked me what had been going on and could I answer his questions, of which I did. He said, was that the reason why our marriage had broken up? And I said, well, there were three of us in this marriage and the pressure of the media was another factor. So the two together were very difficult. But although I still loved Papa, I couldn't live under the same roof as him and likewise with him.
What effect do you think it had on Prince William?
Well, he's a child that's a deep thinker. And we won't know for a few years how it's gone in. But I put it in gently, without resentment or any anger.
Looking back now, do you feel at all responsible for the difficulties in your marriage?
I take full responsibility. I take some responsibility that our marriage went the way it did. I'll take half of it. But I won't take any more than that, because it takes two to get in this situation.
But you do bear some of the responsibility.
Absolutely. We both made mistakes.
Another book that was published recently concerned a Mr. James Hewitt, in which he claimed to have had a very close relationship with you from about 1989, I think. What was the nature of your relationship?
He was a great friend of mine at a very difficult time, yet another difficult time, and he was always there to support me. And I was absolutely devastated when this book appeared, because I trusted him. And because, again, I worried about the reaction on my children. And yes, there was factual evidence in the book, but a lot of it comes from another world. Didn't equate to what happened.
What do you mean?
Well, there was a lot of fantasy in that book. And it was very distressing for me that a friend of mine who I had trusted made money out of me. I really minded about that. And he'd rung me up 10 days before it arrived in the bookshops to tell me that there was nothing to worry about. And I believed him stupidly. And then when it did arrive, the first thing I did was rush down to talk to my children. And William produced a box of chocolates and said, "Mummy, I think you've been hurt. These are to make you smile again." So...
Did your relationship go beyond close friendship.
Yes, it did. Yes.
Were you unfaithful?
Yes, I adored him. Yes, I was in love with him. But I was very let down.
How would you describe your life now? You do live very much on your own, don't you?
Yes, I am. I don't mind that, actually. You know, people think that at the end of the day, a man is the only answer. Actually, a fulfilling job is better for me.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, any gentleman that's been past my door, we've instantly been put together in the media and all hell's broken loose. So that's been very tough on the male friends I've had, and obviously from my point of view.
Does that mean that you feel that for the rest of your life you'll have to be on your own?
No, I'm not really on my own. I've got wonderful friends, I've got my boys, I've got my work. It's just by living in Kensington Palace, obviously it is a little bit isolating, but you know, maybe we all feel like that.
How do you feel about the way the press behaves towards you now?
I still to this day find the interest daunting and phenomenal, because I actually don't like being the centre of attention. When I have my public duties, I understand when I get out of the car, I'm being photographed. But actually, it's now when I go out of my door, my front door, I'm being photographed. I never know where a lens is going to be. A normal day would be followed by four cars. A normal day would come back to my car and find six freelance photographers jumping around me. Some people would say, well, if you had a policeman, it'd make it easier. It doesn't at all. They've decided that I'm still a project after 15, 16 years that sells well, and they all shout at me, telling me that. Oh, come on, Di, look up. If you give us a picture, I can get my children to a better school. And, you know, you can laugh it off, but you get that the whole time. It's quite difficult.
Some people would say that in the early years of your marriage, you were partly responsible for encouraging the press interest. You mm-hmm. danced with people like Wayne Sleep. You seemed mm-hmm. to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. You had a very good and warm relationship. Do you feel any responsibility for the way the press have behaved towards you?
I never encouraged the media. There was a relationship which worked before, but now I can't tolerate it because it's become abusive. And it's harassment. But I don't want to be seen to indulging in self-pity. I'm not. I understand they have a job to do. You could equate it to a soap opera, really. It goes on and on and on, and the story never changes. And each time one enjoys oneself, albeit it's in a different situation, you have to pay for it because people criticise, which comes with the patch, as I said previously. But I am a free spirit, unfortunately for some.
But here at Kensington Palace, are you isolated?
Well, I am by the nature of my situation, yes. But I don't feel sorry for myself in any way. I've got my work that I choose to do, and I got my boys, and I've got lots of opportunities coming up in the next year, visits abroad. I'm about to go to Argentina, which I'm very happy with, and hope very much to continue the good relationship that's now been adapted between the two countries. I hope I can be of help there.
What role do you see for yourself in the future?
I'd like to be an ambassador for this country. I'd like to represent this country abroad. As I have all this media interest, let's not just sit in this country and be battered by it. Let's take them, these people, out and to represent this country and the good qualities of it abroad. When I go abroad, we've got 60 to 90 photographers just from this country coming with me. So let's use it in a productive way to help this country.
You say you feel that your future is as some form of ambassador. Mm. At whose behest is that? On what grounds do you feel that you have the right to think of yourself as an ambassador?
I've been in a privileged position for 15 years, and I've got tremendous knowledge about people and how to communicate. I've learnt that. I've got it, and I want to use it. And when I look at people in public life, I'm not a political animal, but I think the biggest disease this world suffers from in this day and age is the disease of people feeling unloved. And I know that I can give love for a minute, for half an hour, for a day, for a month, but I can give, and I'm very happy to do that, and I want to do that.
Do you think that the British people are happy with you in your role?
I think the British people need someone in public life to give affection, to make them feel important, to support them, to give them light in their dark tunnels. I see it as a possibly unique role, and yes, I've had difficulties, as everybody has witnessed over the years, but let's now use the knowledge I've gathered to help other people in distress.
Do you think you can?
I know I can. I know I can, yeah.
Up until you came into this family, the monarchy seemed to enjoy an unquestioned position at the heart of British life. Do you feel that you're at all to blame for the fact that the survival of the monarchy is now a question that people are asking?
No, I don't feel blame. I mean, once or twice I've heard people say to me that, you know, Diana's out to destroy the monarchy, which has bewildered me, because why would I want to destroy something that is my children's future? I will fight for my children on any level in order for them to be happy and have peace of mind to carry out their duties. But I think what concerns me most of all about how people discuss the monarchy is they become indifferent, and I think that is a problem, and I think that should be sorted out, yes.
When you say indifferent, what do you mean?
They don't care. People don't care anymore. They've been so force-fed with marital problems, whatever. They're fed up. I'm fed up of reading about it. I'm in it. So God knows what people out there must think.
Do you think the monarchy needs to adapt and to change in order to survive?
I understand that change is frightening for people, especially if there's nothing to go to. It's best to stay where you are. I understand that. But I do think that there are a few things that could change that would alleviate this doubt and sometimes complicated relationship between monarchy and public. I think they could walk hand in hand, as opposed to be so distant.
What are you doing to try and effect some kind of change?
Well, with William and Harry, for instance, I take them round homelessness projects. I've taken William and Harry to people dying of AIDS, albeit I told them it was cancer. I've taken the children to all sorts of areas where I'm not sure anyone of that age in this family has been before. And they have a knowledge. They may never use it, but the seed is there. And I hope it will grow, because knowledge is power.
What are you hoping that experience for your children, what impact that experience will have on your children?
I want them to have an understanding of people's emotions, people's insecurities, people's distress, and people's hopes and dreams.
What kind of monarchy do you anticipate?
I would like a monarchy that has more contact with its people. And I don't mean by riding around bicycles and things like that, but just having a more in-depth understanding. And I don't say that as a criticism to the present monarchy. I just say that as what I see and hear and feel on a daily basis in the role I have chosen for myself.
There's a lot of discussion at the moment about how matters between yourself and the Prince of Wales will be resolved. There's even the suggestion of a divorce between you. What are your thoughts about that?
I don't want a divorce. But obviously we need clarity on a situation that has been of enormous discussion over the last 3 years in particular. So all I say to that is that I await my husband's decision of which way we are all going to go.
If he wished a divorce to go through, would you accept that?
I would obviously discuss it with him. But up to date, neither of us have discussed this subject, though the rest of the world seems to have.
Would it be your wish to divorce?
No, it's not my wish.
Why? Wouldn't that resolve matters?
Why would it resolve matters?
It would provide the clarity that you talk about. It would resolve matters as far as the public are concerned, perhaps.
Yes, but what about the children? Our boys, that's what matters, isn't it?
Do you think you'll ever be queen?
No, I don't, no.
Why do you think that?
I'd like to be a queen of people's hearts, in people's hearts. But I don't see myself being queen of this country. I don't think many people would want me to be queen. Actually, when I say many people, I mean the establishment that I'm married into. Because they've decided that I'm a non-starter.
Why do you think they've decided that?
Because I do things differently. Because I don't go by a rule book. Because I lead from the heart, not the head. And albeit that's got me into trouble in my work, I understand that. But someone's got to go out there and love people and show it.
And do you think that because of the way you behave, that's precluded you effectively from becoming queen?
Yes, not precluded me, I wouldn't say that. I just don't think I have as many supporters in that environment than I did. Yeah.
You mean within the royal household?
Mm-hmm. They see me as a threat of some kind. And I'm here to do good. I'm not a destructive person.
Why do they see you as a threat?
I think every strong woman in history has had to walk down a similar path. And I think it's the strength that causes the confusion and the fear. Why is she strong? Where does she get it from? Where is she taking it? Where is she going to use it? Why do the public still support her? When I say public, you go in and do an engagement and there's a great many people there.
Do you think the Prince of Wales will ever be king?
I don't think any of us know the answer to that. And obviously it's a question that's in everybody's head. But who knows? Who knows what fate will produce? Who knows what circumstances will provoke?
But you would know him better than most people. Do you think he would wish to be king?
There was always conflict on that subject with him when we discussed it. And I understood that conflict because it's a very demanding role, being Prince of Wales, but it's equally a more demanding role, being king. And being Prince of Wales produces more freedom now, and being king would be a little bit more suffocating. And because I know the character, I would think that the top job, as I call it, would bring enormous limitations to him. And I don't know whether he could adapt to that.
Do you think it would make more sense, in the light of the marital difficulties that you and the Prince of Wales have had, if the position of monarch passed directly to your son, Prince William?
Well, then you have to see that William's very young at the moment, so do you want a burden like that to be put on his shoulders at such an age? So I can't answer that question.
Would it be your wish that when Prince William comes of age, that he were to succeed the Queen rather than the current Prince of Wales?
My wish is that my husband finds peace of mind, and from that follows other things, yes.
Why have you decided to give this interview now? Why have you decided to speak at this time?
Because we will have been separated 3 years this December, and the perception that has been given of me for the last 3 years has been very confusing, turbulent, and in some areas I'm sure many, many people doubt me. And I want to reassure all those people who have loved me and supported me throughout the last 15 years, so I'd never let them down. That is a priority to me, along with my children.
And so you feel that by speaking out in this way, you'll be able to reassure the people?
The people that matter to me, the man on the street. Yeah, because that's what matters more than anything else.
Some people might interpret this as you simply taking the opportunity to get your own back on your husband.
I don't sit here with resentment. I sit here with sadness because a marriage hasn't worked. I sit here with hope because there's a future ahead. A future for my husband, a future for myself, and a future for the monarchy.
Your Royal Highness, thank you.
That was Diana, Princess of Wales, back in 1995. For those of you who are interested, there is a video investigation by Keith Allen into the death of Diana called Unlawful Killing that can still be found mirrored in various places across the internet. That's all for this week. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers, and broadcast on Bristol Community FM and 12 p.m. every Tuesday lunchtime. If you're outside Bristol or on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Thursday when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find out on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Thank you for listening. So until the same time next week, goodbye.